For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer, my co-hosts. How are you guys?
Hey.
Hey, you guys. Evan, who's on the show today?
This week on the show, I have Lissa Soap. She is most recently the author of a book called Other People's Words, Friendship Loss and the Conversations That Never End. It's the story about the death of two of her close friends. And it's about that loss and recovery and the role that language plays in it. I really enjoyed the book. And Liz is also actually a longtime audio producer and editor. She spent over two decades working with an organization out in the Bay Area that I knew and you may know as Youth Radio. It's now actually called YR Media, but it's a cool organization. It helps young journalists sort of learn how to tell their stories in their own communities in audio form. And Lissa also edits, you guys may not even know this, shows for Vox, although not this one. We talked about her various lives, audio, writing. We talked about getting a PhD and then leaving it behind for journalism. And we talked all about her book. It's a great conversation.
Hey, great.
Did you talk at all about San Francisco? Is there any like nostalgic Evan San Francisco talk in here? Because that's a personal favorite of mine.
We did, but I think it was off mic.
We've already had one Vox shout out in this introduction, but I'd be in remiss if I didn't mention that they help us produce this show. Thanks to everyone over at Vox.
And now here's Evan with Lissa Soap.
Lissa, welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thank you, Evan.
It's nice to see you and it's nice to talk to you. And it was lovely to get a chance to read this book, which sounds like it was many years in the making.
It was.
But before we talk about the book, I want to talk a little bit about your background, partly because it's a unique background. I interview a lot of authors on here, a lot of journalists on here. They all have unique careers, of course, but your path seems different than a lot of people that we've had on the show. First off, because you originally got a PhD, Cultural Studies and Linguistic Anthropology.
In the context of a school of education. So yes, those were the areas that I studied to get a PhD in education.
Now, what was the aim in pursuing a PhD?
Was to be a professor. That is what I thought I would do. So my first job out of college, I worked as a research assistant studying community arts education. And when I started initially a master's program and then it continued on for a PhD, I was studying young artists working in communities with adult professional artists creating work that would be released to a public. So actually, it's interesting. My original core kernel of an idea at the center of even my earliest research was about peer critique. I was always super interested in how we talk to one another as we're developing work. Mm. So it's hard when you're a young artist, you know, to sort of form judgments and then articulate them about the work that your peers are doing, right? It's almost like we don't do that in education. Usually it would be what a teacher would do. And here you've got young people figuring out and finding language to express those kinds of tricky things for one another in order to make the work the strongest version of itself as it is going to go out into the world and reach an audience. So initially I was really curious about those ideas, and I was planning to become a professor and sort of go that academic path, and that changed.
Yeah. It sounds like, from what I know of your bio, that was working. Like, there was an academic job in the offering for you, and then that your transition was rather dramatic.
Thank you. To me, it felt dramatic. I don't know how dramatic it really was in the grand scheme of things, but to me, it was a big shift, right? Because when you're in one of those programs and everything is sort of pointing in the direction towards, you know, getting that tenure track job is like holy grail kind of effort. And partway through my program, I started to have ambivalence about whether that was what I truly wanted. And that ambivalence, I think, came from lots of different sources. But one of them really was, I kind of had a wandering eye towards journalism, you know, and I think I was sort of noticing even in real time that my writing was becoming more and more kind of entrenched in these expectations of how you are going to express yourself in order to get published in academic journals. And I could feel a sort of lifeblood in my writing kind of draining out of it, out of necessity, in order to like sort of be viable in that academic world. Uh-huh. And at the same time, I was aware of all this other kind of storytelling that was happening. And then I had a bit of luck, which was a professor of mine had the idea that a culminating product she wanted to create out of 10 years of research that she and a colleague had done was a documentary video. So I got to work on a team producing that video, and I learned a lot about just the vocabulary of that kind of storytelling. And it was, you know, kind of a challenging process. A lot of us were doing it for the first time, but it did give me like a little bit of a tiptoe towards the world of media creation. Mm-hmm. And then I think the really big shift happened, you know, if I had to pinpoint it to a moment, I was driving across the Bay Bridge one day and I heard a story on the radio from an organization that was called Youth Radio. And it was a teenager on National Public Radio talking about her career path following in her father's footsteps as a postal worker. And it was just this really great story. And at the end of the story, she signed off with like a credit to this place, Youth Radio, and that it was in the East Bay and so close to my home. And so I showed up at this organization, and it was a lot like the places I was studying for my dissertation, but it was not a place I was studying. It was this youth newsroom where young people were telling stories on their terms. And at that time, we were doing a lot of stories for NPR and other public media outlets. The organization had its roots in public media. And I think a big turning point for me at that point was sitting around with these young journalists and musicians and storytellers, and realizing that if I became a professor, I would be sitting in the back of a room with a notebook, and I would be trying to track their discourse. And then I would go off to an office and I would try to drum up analysis of that material. And while, you know, there was still some appeal to that, like, I didn't want to be in the back of the room. I wanted to be like with them, and I wanted to be learning from them and learning with them and creating stories with them and reaching audience with them. And so I kind of talked my way into a role within that organization, and that sort of put me on a different path.
And what was it that so attracted you to that newsroom?
I mean, I can't imagine who wouldn't be attracted to that. Like, if you had a chance to step into that room, that space, and it was young people it's predominantly young people of color, queer youth, you know, young people who are system engaged, voices that are so necessary and vital to be driving conversation. It just felt like such fresh and important work, and also really fun, you know, like there's just so much energy. And YR from the very early days was journalism and music and art. So as much as I was there for the journalism, it was always like a mix of all of these different modalities of expression. And, you know, obviously this book that we're here to talk about has a through line of a philosophy of language that I first learned about in grad school.
Yeah.
That all also felt very alive in those spaces. So it didn't feel like I was like sort of walking away from those initial interests that got me to enter a program to study education. It just allowed me a different vantage point into those questions.
The other thing I wondered about was, you know, in media now, there's so much negativity, I mean, rightly so, about the industry and where the industry has gone, the contraction, the layoffs, even the ups and downs of the podcasting business, which seemed like it happened really fast.
Yeah.
But I imagine the perspective is different when you're working with teenagers with stories to tell who are not like immersed in that aspect of things. And I'm wondering what sort of perspective that gave you on the work versus the sort of business of the work.
I mean, it's interesting. I think that an awareness of the business of the work is always also present in spaces where young people are kind of finding pathways towards sort of career, because there have to be really sobering conversations about what are the opportunities here. And if a young, you know, let's say a kid from Oakland High, you know, has a story on All Things Considered, and it's a pretty big deal and millions of people are hearing it, and if it's an issue that was important to that reporter, you know, it has a shot at actually having impact that will matter to them and to other people who hear it and influencers and policymakers who are listening. And all of that is like a high. But we were pretty committed from that and explicit, even in those early days, like that cannot be the highest moment in the creator's life. Like it needs to build towards something that will allow them to have greater opportunity, whether it's in education or in their own career pathways going forward. To like, so looking for that kind of structural change and not just like a highlight moment of hitting with an audience with a single story. So I think given that, then you're question about the realities of the industry and also in nonprofit newsrooms like YR and others, that the reality actually hits the organization in ways that the young people are also aware of. So yeah, it didn't feel quite as sort of like protected or sequestered as one might think.
And the other aspect of this that I feel like leads into the book is you've spent a long time in your career sort of marshaling other people's work. So producing and editing hundreds of stories by other people. And what do you think you learned about sort of storytelling that you like brought into the process of this larger endeavor of telling a story that you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for asking that question, because I am so keenly aware of how much my own voice is a product of all of those editing relationships and co-producing relationships with other people's words, you know, and there's an acknowledgement of a group of young people that I worked with decades ago. I mean, none of us are young anymore, honestly. But I remember just those, that was when my voice, I was sort of not clear on what I had to say outside of these like sort of academic frameworks. And so getting to be so intimately in their stories, I will forever feel indebted to those then young people who are now kind of writers and educators and therapists and lots of other things that they're doing in their lives. But we share that history. And in some ways, like, yeah, I feel like my voice is sort of a product of that time.
Can you describe the sort of process you went through in just deciding to start the book, deciding to write the book? You were working with other people's voices and also like literally voices like audio. And then it's a very different process to sit down and write something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe just a little bit of context for the book itself. So around the same time, about 10 years ago, two very close friends of mine died in very different ways. And so Christine died slowly after a long and mysterious illness, and Johnny died in an instant while he was swimming in a lake and was run over by a boat. And so the book is a story of those two friendships and those two relationships in my life, and also about friendship itself as this great love in our lives that we don't always recognize in the same way as blood ties or, you know, marriages or other relationships that have like a formal shape. And it is an exploration of how it felt and what it was like to both lose those friends and then to find them again and again through language. And so I've talked a little bit about Christine and Johnny, right, as the mm-hmm. sort of main characters whom I lost. And then with them came Christine's partner of 17 years, Mercy, and Johnny's wife, Emily. So those are like the present. And then my boyfriend and my husband, Chaz, those intersecting relationships are the present day narratives of the book. And then there was this other presence that was helping me to understand what I was feeling and experiencing. And that is this linguist, Mikhail Bakhtin. Mm-hmm. And so he is a philosopher of language I studied in graduate school and whose ideas immediately resonated for me. You know, his phrase is that our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words. So Bakhtin was just obsessed with the conversations that exist within us, within our voices, the layers, the double voicing that happens within any one person's speech, right? So all of these ideas are swirling around. And I feel like there were sort of two moments where it felt like things began for other people's words. And one was on the flight home from visiting Christine for the last time. And I started free writing to just sort of take in what had just happened. That Chaz and I had flown across country because Mercy had called us and said, you need to come. She has very few words left and this is the end of her life. And so if you want to see her again, you need to get on a plane. And we did. And by the time I got there, I think she maybe spoke 5 words while we were there. And yet I felt this totally like brimming feeling of her voice being with us. And sometimes it was because I was speaking both sides of our conversations, and sometimes it was her remembered words, and sometimes it was the sense of imagined words that she might say. And it just was not what I had imagined it would feel like to go and experience her silence and this anticipated loss that we knew was coming, because along with the sadness and sorrow of losing her, there was this kind of just overwhelming presence of all that she had ever said and the sense that we would need to sort of carry those conversations going forward from that point on. And even in that swirl of confusing feelings, I kind of thought of Bakhtin. I really did think of this idea of our speech filled to overflowing with other people's words. So I think on the flight home, I was starting to just free write around some of those ideas and how they interlaced. And the other moment was actually, you know, Johnny died before Christine, and as I said, in such a different way. And I'm really close to his wife, Emily. And in the days and weeks after Johnny died, Emily was in so much conversation with him and asking, you know, where is he? Like, really, really, where is he? And writing to him and continuing to write to him and going to the Apple store and seeing if she could just pull any remnant of his voice that was on any of his devices somewhere that she could hold and continue to re-experience. And she shared with me some of the letters that she wrote to Johnny and the conversations that she had with Johnny. And so I think that was another just experience that was unfolding that felt so incredibly powerful to be close to what she was coming up with in order to live and to go forward. And it felt like there were some through lines there as I started to experience both of these losses that I think that's where I began to imagine some kind of project.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. built to be accessible, empowering, and community building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
It's loud, deafening, cacophonous.
It's a nightmare.
Oppressive.
And just what is it that many people think is pretty nightmarish and yet are still willing to shell out quite a bit of money for a night out at a restaurant?
Sound is the number one complaint that diners have about their experience. So why are restaurants so loud, and when did that start happening?
Is there anything anyone can do to fix it? We've got the answers on the latest episode of Gastropod.
All that, plus the science behind the perfect playlist to accompany your meal. This special episode is part of our new collaboration with the podcast Switched on Pop.
Find Gastropod and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
As a reader, the Mikhail Bakhtin part of it, it's the kind of thing that I find difficult to pull off. Like, people can overdo that, and it can sort of seem like, oh, this is like a fake narrative, like a dual narrative, but it doesn't really fit. But then I found I'd never heard of him before. So I was suddenly entranced by these ideas. And then I found myself, every time he came back, I was like, oh, good, he's back, to give
Yay,
some context
I'm
for
so
this
happy to hear you
situation. But I mean, you studied his work before, but did it already have this personal resonance for you since you studied it? Or is this something that after these losses, you sort of realized, oh, I can draw on something that I studied back when I was, you know, getting your PhD or whatnot?
Yeah, I think it was sort of a combination. No, it did not have the same emotional, evocative resonance back then, because I hadn't experienced losses like this before. So I hadn't been so kind of at a loss to understand both how I was feeling and then what I was noticing around the language that we were all using to kind of hold these loved ones close. Also in these really, really early days, it's funny, like Mercy and I had a joke about this, that I would never call this book a book. I would call it projet, like, cause I just didn't want to like jinx anything. And also like, I didn't know if I would be able to pull it off as a book. And also because I do other media storytelling formats, I was like, maybe it won't be a book. Maybe it'll be this other thing, like I said. But it, so it's for a lot of reasons, I would call it projet, you know? So in the projet era of other people's words, I was like sort of going back into my early Bakhtin texts where I had like annotated through all the edges, but it was done initially for the sake of these kind of concepts that I was trying to work out. And then I was coming up short, like with my own ability to remember and grasp the fullness of what he was trying to say, and especially like his historical context, which I had to like really learn from scratch. And so I had this idea to call Carol Emerson, who is... she translated his work into English from Russian, and she has written some of those important papers and books about him over decades. She's a professor at Princeton. And it was so funny because like when you're in my academic mode, you don't call the person that you're putting in parenthetical citations. You just read their book and then you like do what you will with it, right? But I'd spent enough time in journalism that it like, it occurred to me, I was like, oh, wait, I don't have to just like try to figure this out myself. I should have a conversation with this person. And so as I said, it was so early. It was almost embarrassed to write to her and be like, so I'm kind of writing this book. I don't know what it is. And I wrote to her, and she's like an emeritus professor, you know, very accomplished. And she wrote me back right away. And she said, I would be happy to talk, but can it be in a couple of days because my father just died? So she was just coming off of this fresh experience of profound loss. And when we then spoke, she shared with me that when she was in the room for her father's final words, and she told me his final words, Bakhtin was in her mind too. And she said to me, and I wish I had her exact words, but it was essentially like, Bakhtin believed that when you got a hold of a word, it has tremendous reanimating power. And she felt it in the presence of, you know, her father transitioning, And I experienced it. So that was, I think, an affirming moment for me where I was seeing how Carol had sort of taken Bakhtin into her life in such a full way. And so it kind of almost gave me permission to do the same.
Well, this idea that our words sort of don't quite belong to us or only partially belong to us, and because they come from other people and then we animate them and then they go to other people. Uh-huh. That theory, it also seemed embedded in this, what I found to be fascinating mystery about the attribution of his works, that he was so dedicated to that idea that there are these books that he didn't really want to take credit for, but then was given credit for posthumously by other people.
Yeah, and not even posthumously, but even while he was still alive, some of the other authors had died, and it was determined that Bakhtin had actually perhaps written some of these books that had been attributed to others. But, you know, even that story has kind of reversed itself. And now, and you sort of get that. I talk a little bit about that in the chapter about the son of one of these authors whose authorship had come into question because books were sort of set, you know, attributed to Bakhtin. And his son spent much of the latter part of his life trying to reestablish the rightful authorship of his own father, as opposed to sort of giving away that material as if it had all been produced by Bakhtin. So there's a lot of mythology, it turns out, about Bakhtin and the Bakhtin circle that now is being reexamined. And there's, you know, a fair amount of consensus now that those books, in fact, probably were written by the people whose names are on the spines. And in fact, maybe Bakhtin was influenced by their ideas. So it just troubles all of this, you know, investment that we have, overinvestment, I would say, in sort of who possesses which ideas, and which does feel very fitting in the deepest sense for somebody whose his whole notion of language is based on the fact that our speech is produced by other people's words.
Mm-hmm. But then it sort of ties back into your writing of this book.
Yeah.
Because you're also telling other people's stories, and like telling anyone's story is delicate in the best of circumstances. But in this case, you're talking about two friends who had lost their partners or former partners, and you are to some extent going to be the person, at least in this moment, who's telling their story. So how did you approach that question of like, they could write this book also from their perspective, it's a different book, but you're saying I'm going to use this to tell the story that I feel should be told.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Delicate, tender, sometimes painful and complicated to sort of get to the place where this story felt like the one that, you know, I could put a frame on, but with a real understanding that, you know, the story of Emily's grief and joy in life with and after Johnny, and Mercy's experience of who Christine was, not only to her, but to their students as an activist, as, you know, who was 20 years older than we are and had such a long and committed life before I even knew her. Like, there's so much more to say. And Mercy and Emily are both writers, and Emily is also a visual artist, and each of them has and will continue to tell those stories. And I think part of what we worked through together is this kind of frame of friendship. What is it like to love and lose great friends? And so that means sometimes being up close to the grief that Emily experienced as Johnny's life partner, or up close to the grief that Mercy works out in a relationship with Christine, where because of illness and other factors, their relationship had come apart even before Christine died, right? So they each have their own trajectories and acute lived experiences that they're making sense of. And the piece of it that exists on the pages of other people's words is this story of friendship.
Were there times when they wanted you to stop?
I mean, I've been working on it for 9 years. So there were times that yeah. I did stop, you know, not like stop, like I'm not doing this anymore, but like really big pause on things happening. And sometimes that was about things happening in their lives. And sometimes it was about things happening in my life. So I think that this is not a book that could have ever been rushed, you know, and I think the times when it did pick up speed were probably the trickier ones to manage, because it's when you don't have as much control over the kind of the pacing of things. But there were definitely boundaries drawn, mm-hmm. right? There's plenty of things that aren't in the book because they don't belong to me. I mean, I think it's interesting because I'm always aware when I say words like belong to, because the book and Bakhtin question. But I do think that certain experiences belong to people. And so there were aspects of each of these storylines and my own life, frankly, that aren't here. And that was out of love for Christine and Johnny and then for Mercy and Emily.
A lot of the book is maybe obviously about language. And you include a lot of Christine's correspondence with, yeah. with you, with your husband, Chaz, and, you know, she's experiencing cognitive decline of some sort that's happening. And I'm wondering, why did you decide to include her correspondence over time?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is that Christine lived by the word, you know, more than anyone else I know, like reading, writing, literature, poetry, you know, it was just how she went through life was, and she was constantly producing letters. She was very old fashioned letters, postcards, you know, it wasn't until late in her life that we got to emails and texts and she went kicking and screaming, you know, finally relenting to digital correspondence. And so that was who she was. And yes, there was a way in which including her correspondence was a way to open up the change in her language, which came before the diagnosis. And so it explains a lot of what happened in our lives, and especially between Mercy and Christine, because as I mentioned, you know, Christine started to retreat and behave in really unfamiliar, uncharacteristic ways for quite some time before her illness got a name and a diagnosis. And so kind of the imprint of those changes on the way she showed up on the page felt like a really important indication of sort of how she was living out her life. And, you know, and it came out typographically in the way that, you know, her sentences changed and became more fragments that would end with strings of exclamation points or question marks or not even ellipses, but like rows of periods. And there was so much kind of a will to continue expressing and writing that I experienced in that correspondence that felt true to who she was as a writer who lived her life that way and was not going to let anything stop her from continuing these routines of sitting down with paper and pen and ultimately on a keyboard because she had no choice, and just continue to put her words out in order to reach the people that she loved. So that felt like it needed to be a part of her story. And then I think there is also, you know, there's a moment in the book that I write about where Mercy, it was an earlier draft of the book, but she came out to visit and I handed her all the pages that I had written so far. And we sat on my back deck and she had read them all. And she noticed something in the book that I hadn't noticed myself, which is that there's so many scenes involving the ocean, which was very, very important to Mercy and Christine, and also played an important role in Emily and Johnny's life, the water. And so Mercy asked me, have you ever read this, you know, one of Christine's favorite poems by Elizabeth Bishop, At the Fish Houses? And I had not read it, but Mercy pulled it up on her phone and she started reading the lines of this poem. And it like, I was like, why do I feel like I've heard this before? These images of somebody dipping their hand into the water and the ache of the cold and then licking your fingers to taste the salt. And I was like, why does this all sound so familiar? And I realized that it was because in some of the notes that Christine had written to me and Chaz late into her illness, when you could almost mistake some of her sentences as sort of losing meaning, I noticed some of those very same images of Christine going to the ocean and licking her fingers and feeling the ache on her wrist. And this is all a way to answer your question about like why including that correspondence was important, because it was only in the specifics of that correspondence that I found these like footprints of poetry that remained in her words so far into the progression of her illness, and in a way that just made me feel like she was less alone in that moment in her life because she had Elizabeth Bishop with her, somehow interlacing with her words. So that, I guess, just as somebody who loves language, and by that I mean me, but also Christine, you know, then the language was there to like allow you to experience Christine in all of her precise forms of self-expression.
And there's also this notion that there's a shared territory between voices. There's also this sort of literal manifestation of that that's more and more common, where people, as you say, have recordings.
Yeah.
Like Emily was trying to get the recordings off of her partner's phone. And you cite this great pop-up magazine story by Cord Jefferson, where he has his mother's voicemails. And you had done some reporting on AI and AI bots. And I'm just wondering how that all fits together in terms of, now there are efforts to like preserve people's voices specifically so they can be reanimated. And how does that connect with this theory?
Yeah, no, it's so interesting because, well, in Other People's Words, the book, I do write about Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed.
Right, right.
After Lou Reed died, Laurie Anderson became an artist in residence in a computer science department at a university. And this was pre-ChatGPT, but essentially using a generative AI system that trained itself on anything Laurie Anderson had ever said that was available on the internet, everything that Lou Reed had ever said. And then these computer scientists worked with Anderson to produce poetry that was a product of the combination of their voices. So I talk about it in the book as a kind of impossible larynx that like somehow blends the voices of the two. And there's an article in the New York Times where I learned about Laurie Anderson's use of generative AI in that way. And as you said, like I actually just completely apart from Other People's Words, I have worked on reporting in various newsrooms that I'm a part of, working on projects related to generative AI. So I've thought deeply about what it means that now it is undeniable when we, you know, experience ChatGPT. This is a tool, right, that is takes like oceans of data of whatever, you know, it has access to that is hoovered into large language model. And then out of that generates a human-like voice, right, that we know is derivative. There's all sorts of debates about, you know, is it doing right by the original, quote-unquote, original authors of whatever that content is, and how it hallucinates. I mean, there's fascinating conversations about it, and we're all kind of up in arms about it. And it is pretty striking to like be experiencing that cultural moment, knowing that Bakhtin would say all of language is like this, that the ChatGPT and generative AI is maybe a heightened version of how it is that we all come to find our words, right? That we don't get them from a dictionary. We don't sort of drum them up from within ourselves, that they are a product of relationships that came before us. And each iteration is our own. And there's something new or generative about what I'm saying versus what somebody else would say who's been exposed to some of the same material as I have, but not others. But what I love about thinking about AI through the lens of Bakhtin is it allows us to maybe exhale and be like, this isn't like, we don't, maybe it's not a panic. Maybe it's not so much of a departure from how we live and make language across our lives. And there is also cause for grave concern, right? Because if there's anything I know from Bakhtin and from the stories of Other People's Words, it's like, the humanity of these voices is what gives them life. And so there is an idea from Bakhtin, you know, that I write about in the book. He talks about loopholes. He talks about words with a sidewards glance. Basically, loopholes are words or language that always opens up alternative meanings. There's always a loophole. There's never a final period at the end of a sentence where everything has been definitively stated once and for all. And so I have thought about, I was like, okay, well, what can we learn from Bakhtin that applies to this generative AI moment? And I think loopholes is something really important, because I learned about the possibility now, if you're a creator, if you're a, let's say, a visual artist, and you've made digital work, and you don't want your piece to be used to train AI, you can insert pixels into your piece that are not visible to the human eye, but break the model. They kind of like fuck with the model. Are you allowed to swear on the show? they break it so that either your work kind of dodges recognition or it gets misrecognized. It's like a hack, right? It's like, and it's sneaky, and it's like, I love it. You know, it's just like this sort of like, oh, you think you can sort of like suck in all of my juices? I have another, you have another thing coming. And so anyway, I think Bakhtin's idea of loophole and that example of these like devious pixels that break the system are doing something similar, which is acknowledging there is a larger system here, that a system of language that is bigger than us, you know, populates our words. And yet there always are and need to be these ruptures, these ways of cracking open that system. And Bakhtin delighted in that. And I am sort of extra interested in where that's playing out in real time for us as we figure out how to live with generative AI.
It's interesting that the book took so many years since that. It's sort of like that technology evolved over that period of time. But it's also, I mean, you know, your own grief, your own perception of loss changes over all those years. I mean, I lost a friend a couple years before that. And I was just thinking about how in the beginning, you just do so much to hold on to the person, especially if it's a younger person or if it happens suddenly or unexpectedly. And there's like events and anniversaries and people get together. And then as the years pass, it becomes this sort of one-on-one dialogue that you have with the person as a lot of that stuff falls away. But it made me wonder, what brought you to the finish line? Like the book that you would have finished 9 years ago, or let's say 8 years ago, versus the book 4 years ago, it's a different book. So why now, I guess, is maybe the question that I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so grateful that it has taken as long as it has, because there are earlier versions of this book where I was like convinced that it was ready and I hadn't quite found the story yet. And because I think it could have been put out into the world in a more academic way, where like there was this Bakhtinian frame and then each of these stories and other stories would emerge almost as evidence for that way of looking at language. And I'm so glad that that was unsuccessful because that would have been, it wouldn't have gotten to the heart of the story. And so part of when you asked, like, how did I know it was done or getting to the finish line? I mean, part of it was out of my control. Like I thought I was done plenty of other moments. And then I was like told in no uncertain terms, like, you know, we'll pass or whatever. And then I was like, oh shit, okay, here I go. Let me get back in. And thankfully I had, you know, really amazing support in lots of different parts of my life to sort of stay at it. And I did a workshop, a Tin House workshop that my friend Nicole Fleetwood insisted that I do, basically, that was incredibly helpful. And then I think spending time with Mercy and Emily really also was so important in sort of working through what's here and what was missing. I mean, it was really important to Emily. And she said to me, I cannot be in this book as like a tragic widow. And so for her, it was incredibly important, like you described, that how her grief changed needed to be there, or she was not going to want to go forward. She did not want to show up only at the point of the greatest sorrow and shock and despair. She needed to be there in all of her fierceness, her anger, and really, really her joy that she found for herself. And so I think that having that time for that to play out in her life and for her to say that to me and for us to talk together about, okay, what does that then look like? What writing is she doing? Because she's doing writing that is telling her story and she needs space and time to do that. And then with Mercy, you know, and I want to like respect privacy around this, you know, just like her own very complicated relationship to her grief, given that the relationship had ended before Christine, before we knew she was sick, and then certainly before she died. Mercy has said to me that working, you know, kind of being alongside and working with me and supporting and being a part of other people's words has given her a way to even allow herself to grieve, maybe, and to find her way into that. And part of it comes out in the very last chapter. This book doesn't really have chapters, but the last scene in the book happens when Mercy has these two boxes in her basement that Christine sent to her and labeled "For M When I'm Gone." I guess for anybody who hasn't read the book, I need to say out loud, like, Christine never stopped loving Mercy. And she put into these boxes cherished items that she wanted Mercy to have when she knew that she was dying. And they sat in Mercy's basement. She opened them at one point, because before mm-hmm. Christine's memorial service, she did reference some of what was in the boxes when Mercy stood up on the podium and spoke. But she couldn't really bring herself to go inside those boxes. And over the course of all of these years, and in some cases, in part through talking about other people's words and what was in there and what was needed, not that long before we submitted this manuscript, like, not, you know, very far in, like, I thought I was done, frankly.
Oh.
And then Mercy goes to these boxes and she's like live texting me what she's finding and what she's feeling. And she's just uncovering and she's taking pictures of everything in the box and sending it to me. And she makes a discovery of something in the box that I won't say here, because it's sort of a moment that I want readers to be able to discover in real time alongside the people in the book. But she makes this really, really, really poignant kind of transformative discovery of something inside the boxes that really causes her to change some fundamentals of how she understands the end of Christine's life and their love. And I think that moment happening, without it, I think the book would have maybe not been complete. And once that moment happened, I sort of knew that was really the end of the story. You know, that was the end of this story and the end of my telling of this story.
And when you were writing it, how much did you feel like this is for people who might have experienced something similar versus I am just writing my experience and reflecting on it?
I think it was both, you know. I think it was, and I also, I really felt like the presence of Johnny and Christine, you know, Johnny's humor, Johnny's laugh, Johnny's just like fearlessness, like, you know, he just lived on no one else's rules but his own. And, you know, yeah. And then sometimes I felt driven by my own longing to just understand what it was feeling like. And then I do feel like there was something about the, just as a person who I have found so much meaning in these sort of ideas that are so generous and like unexpected, like how what Bakhtin allowed me to see in the world that shifted my thinking. And so I feel like maybe there was some sense of like, oh, maybe this is something that would have something to offer other people who are experiencing loss.
Well, now that it's out, you both have to go and talk about it, but also, and I've already done this myself as well, is it's going to bring up in people who read it their own experiences, and
yeah,
they're also going to want to tell you about them. And how ready for that mm-hmm. are you, and how has it been to experience that part of
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, it's really, you're right. And that's like a great, you know, kind of gift and responsibility. I think when you tell a story like this, you have to then be ready to like receive other people's experiences, especially people who haven't had other people to talk to about these things. And so I did a reading, and most of the people at the reading were my friends, but there were a couple people there who were just wandered in as part of the bookstore events. This was at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. And there was a woman there who said, you know, she's like, the last thing I would want to do at an event like this is talk about myself, but I need to share that, you know, I lost a very dear friend of mine and the child of another friend of hers had died by suicide all in the last very recent period of time. And she said, being here in this community, the community within other people's words, and then there was also like a lot, just a sort of sense of friendship within the room of people who were connected in one way or another. And she said, it makes me feel less alone. And so I was like, you know, that was like a greatest aspiration for this book. It feels like grandiose to sort of want or expect that. But if there are people who, you know, come to this story and start noticing the things that their own families have done to hold on to voices of others or their friendships, like honoring their friendships in ways maybe they haven't given themselves permission to, or, you know, like I'm ready for that and want that all to be happening for people. That would be an amazing like outcome of this story going out into the world. I did get, I'm just thinking, you know, I've heard from a lot of people who are also connected to people in the book. And so Johnny had this like crew of friends before I was friends with him that were just, they were anarchists and they were like doing all these direct actions all over the country and all over the world. He just had a wild, amazing life, you know, and I was sort of his square friend, like, you know, like, and so these friends are all the people who are part of his life. Then we all gather once a year, we meet up at a restaurant that Johnny liked in the East Bay. And one of the people in that community of friends has 3 years ago lost their life partner. And they wrote to me just a couple days ago and sent pictures of them like reading past the pages of other people's words out into the treetops and blue sky, and was sharing like what they were, what it was like to experience like Johnny in these pages, but also the loss of their beloved. And I'm sure I will like cherish those notes, and that'll be like the best stuff to come out of the book is like real genuine moments like that.
Well, Lissa, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's show. Lissa's book is called Other People's Words. It is out now. You can find it everywhere. This show is edited by Susan Peterson. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. I'm Evan Ratliff. Thank you for listening. We produce this show in partnership with Vox, and we will see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.